is the Tasmanian Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and Tasmania.
Coming up today, a workshop underway on King Island to try and save two small birds whose existence is threatened.
They're right on the edge of extinction, which just makes it all the more important that that the attention is on these two birds at the moment, and hopefully some real effective action comes out of the workshop.
And no messing about pruning the olive trees at one Tasmanian grove.
There are lots of different ways described, and I think everybody sort of finds a way that suits them. I actually pruned with a chainsaw for the first time last year, and that took my pruning time down from several weeks to a matter of days.
That story coming up later in the program, but first, a case of Hendra virus has been confirmed in a horse on a New South Wales property in the largest thoroughbred breeding area in the Southern Hemisphere. An unvaccinated mare contracted the virus late last week at a property near Scone in the Hunter Valley and had to be euthanised. All the previous recorded Hendra cases have been in the north of the state, making this the first time the virus has been diagnosed that far south. The virus has the potential to spread to humans too, as Tim Fuchs reports.
The New South Wales Department of Primary Industries says the horse developed neurological signs last Friday and was euthanised after it became unresponsive. Paul Freeman is a senior veterinary officer.
It's in an older horse, an older mare, on a large property, you know, northwest of Scone. The horse, it was in some yards and suddenly developed a neurological disease, and the horse succumbed quite quickly, deteriorated quite quickly, and was euthanized by the property owners. It was an unvaccinated horse. Afterwards, they had some thoughts that they should get a tender status checked, and it was sampled on Sunday by a district veterinarian, and has come back positive.
Given the nature of the disease, is it something that's usually diagnosed after the horse has died? Is it the progression of the disease that quick?
Well, it normally is. Yeah, the clinical illness is normally 1 to 2 days. In this case, the horse was severely sick for a day, and the owners elected to put the horse out of its misery. The suffering, I guess. But in most cases, a veterinarian might be called to examine a horse that's sick and take samples. So, normally it's Hendra is characterised by a couple of things, usually a sudden deterioration and also some vague signs early, and that's why it can be confused with a lot of other things initially, colicky or a stomach upset, or they're the common things that people think of who own horses initially, and it's only that rapid deterioration that occurs in the majority of cases that is a hallmark of the disease.
New South Wales Health is conducting risk assessments of people who have had contact with the affected horse and are controlling the movement of animals and people on and off the property. There have been 22 horse deaths from Hendra in New South Wales since the first reported case in 2006. This latest death occurred in the heart of the largest thoroughbred breeding area in the Southern Hemisphere and has put the industry on alert. The president of the Hunter Thoroughbred Breeders Association, Cameron Collins, however, is confident there's no particular risk to local thoroughbreds.
This horse was located well away from the general thoroughbred breeding areas, so at this stage there's no particular risk to horses in the Hunter Thoroughbred breeding area. In general, Hendra virus infection of horses is associated with close proximity to flying foxes, so there's very good science to show that that's how the virus is spread, and horses that have been infected in the past have been in close proximity to flying fox roosting areas. So horses have been fed under those areas and, you know, been highly exposed to flying fox excretions and that sort of thing. So the general message is horses and flying foxes do not mix, and horse owners should be very diligent about keeping their horses away from flying foxes.
This latest case will again reignite the debate over Hendra vaccinations. For years, there have been discussions about the effectiveness of the vaccine and the cost, which can be several hundred dollars a year. Jane Bennett is the local land services veterinarian in the Upper Hunter and is back at the affected property today. She's urging horse owners in the region to take the usual precautions.
We've known that we have fruit bats in the area for many years, and we should make sure we take the same precautions that we've always taken. So vaccination is our best protection. Other than that, normal management processes like making sure you don't feed and water under trees, particularly fruiting trees, is important in part of that control.
There's some resistance, though, to vaccinations because of the cost and having to renew that vaccination time after time. Are you suggesting here that there needs to be that real consideration about the virus if it gets into the horses?
I think it needs to be a personal decision. We do know that the horses that get affected by the virus are certainly euthanized. And we also need to be aware of the human health risk that's associated with people that have handled those horses. In this particular instance, the New South Wales Public Health have been involved in assessing and assisting those people that were exposed prior to the horse being euthanized.
Veterinarian Jane Bennett ending that report by Tim Fuchs on the discovery of a horse contracting the Hendra virus in the Hunter Valley. The further south the Hendra virus has been detected so far. Still to come in the country, the ACCC raises concerns about the takeover of agribusiness Ruralco. Well, conservation efforts are underway on King Island to bring two tiny birds back from the brink of extinction, the brown thornbill and the scrub tit. The birds, which are about the size of a ping pong ball, were surveyed in March. The scientists have returned to the island this week to share a potential recovery program with the community. Reporter Larissa Smith spoke to Australian National University's Dr. Matt Webb and Dr. Sally Bryan from the Tasmanian Land Conservancy.
So we already knew that the King Island scrub tit and the King Island brown thornbill were in trouble. And we had a little bit more of an idea about the King Island scrub tit from some previous work that we did. But this trip was really just throwing more resources at trying to understand their distribution and abundance across the island. Sort of more effort than has been thrown at them previously. And it's just really helped us sort of solidify just our understanding of what they actually need, where they are, and where they're likely to be, where we mightn't have surveyed. Most importantly, what we can do into the future to try and turn them around, because they're right on the edge of extinction, but which just makes it all the more important that that the attention is on these two birds at the moment, and hopefully some real effective action comes out of the workshop.
Those surveys back in March revealed that the population was slightly bigger than what you initially thought.
By a few birds. Anything's a win when populations get to this size, but it's probably the biggest discovery from the survey was actually realising that the King Island brown thornbill was, there's more birds still persisting than was previously thought, but that's also in the context of that much survey effort had never really been put in, and not in a systematic way. No one really knew, but it turns out that in the core area that they've been known from, where there's only been no more than half a dozen records for the last 50 years, that they're actually using most suitable habitat within that core location, small though it may be.
King Island has a suite of threatened birds because most of our islands all around the world have endemic species that are under enormous threat. King Island has undergone massive land clearance over decades. So the habitat where these two critically endangered birds are clinging on is still diminishing. So it's through this recent research work through ANU that we've now got a better handle on the habitat types that these two species may require, and an opportunity to harness the great efforts and capacity of the local community to not only protect the habitat that's left, but look at ways of increasing and working on these two species because they are King Island endemics.
Is there a willingness from not only the farming community but the broader population on King Island to do their bit?
Island communities all around the world are resilient and they bond together, and I've got no doubt that the King Island community will show an amazing capacity to look after these birds once they have some support and some collective effort from the rest of Tasmania and nationally. So the Tasmanian Land Conservancy is really privileged to come into this space to look at ways that we can protect private land that has these two species on it, either through purchase for covenanting or protection through permanent reserves, or even working with the community through our Land for Wildlife program and monitoring through Wild Tracker. So a number of programs we can offer up to the community to grow their capacity and their understanding of the importance of these two birds.
What's the right environment to create ongoing breeding populations? Is there a sort of species or a sort of a wildlife corridor, so to speak, to help these birds?
King Island brown thornbill, so far all the evidence primarily sort of points towards eucalypt forest or other forest types supporting eucalypts, and they need to be of a relatively decent age, so not really young region, but a lot of that regenerating forest could be absolutely critical for the bird's survival into the future. And the King Island scrub tit primarily relies on the presence of Melaleuca ericifolia, and they love the swamp forests dominated by that, but they're also through a whole other range of forest types on the island where the Melaleucas occur as a subdominant or at lower densities. But again, there has to be some of the elements of that forest need to be sort of relatively mature, and the scrub tits also are really heavily reliant on just having a really dense, brushy structural complexity in the understory.
We're finding at the TLC, the more we work with farmers in the Midlands, that they're embracing nature on their property and they're using it really smartly through economic means, through their branding. And I think there's a real opportunity with King Island for the landholders over there to really use the fact that they're protecting habitat for these two critically endangered birds as a way of marketing their produce to show that they are living with wildlife and they are sharing their productive land with natural values. So markets all around the world now are looking for green certification. We're finding it with wool, we're finding it with other products, and King Island already has such a fantastic brand name for its cheese and its milk. Here's an opportunity to embrace the fact that it's also working in the conservation space, and that's worth a few extra dollars on top of a product that they can sell.
That's Dr. Sally Bryant from the Tasmanian Land Conservancy. We also heard from Dr. Matt Webb from the Australian National University, talking there to Larissa Smith. The pair are on King Island with other scientists talking to the community about how to preserve the brown thornbill and the scrub tit, two tiny birds. Still to come on the Country Hour, pruning the olive trees with a chainsaw at one Tasmanian grove. And in just a moment, we'll head to a Northwest Tasmanian timber company where two major projects have been completed.
Hi, I'm Yumi Steins. Ladies, we need to talk about abortion.
I really don't like the word abortion. I don't know why. After having three, I should be able to get used to it. But for some reason, for me, psychologically, when I say termination of pregnancy, I don't know if it's like makes it seem more clinical. But for some reason, that's how I feel more comfortable.
Ladies, we need to talk. Find all new episodes wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
The Tasmanian Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and Tasmania.
And just a reminder too that because of the Bob Hawke Memorial tomorrow, the edition of the Country Hour on Friday will start at 1 o'clock, a special half-hour program from 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. Now to Smithton, where Britain Timbers have finished two major projects that will improve the company's sustainability credentials. It includes new sheds to speed up the drying process and solar panels to help reduce their power use. General Manager Sean Britton explains how they're generating more high-value timber products for the market.
They got installed about 6 to 8 months ago. They've been operational for about 3 months now. The sheds are designed to dry timber in. Traditionally, timber was dried in the yards here in Smithton, and as you can see from the weather today, which is pretty ordinary, timber can take a long time to dry in Smithton. So what we're doing is we're putting timber fresh off the saw into the new sheds, and we're aiming to cut our drying time by about 20 to 30% by putting the timber through the sheds.
That must have a big impact on your bottom line.
Well, the aim is not only quicker recovery, so quicker turnover of timber, but we're looking to increase the recovered volume that we get out of the timber, and we're hoping for about a 10% increase in recovery.
Is that because under the sheds more timber makes the specs? How does that work?
We'll have timber sitting in our yard here in Smithton for about up to 18 months, even 2 years sometimes. And you can get a lot of deterioration, you can get a lot of mould and other defects through the weather conditions, through February, for example. We have searing hot easterly winds and they don't do the timber any good at all. So by putting the timber in controlled conditions inside a controlled shed, we're looking to eliminate a lot of that degrade that we get and have more volume of timber to sell into the marketplace.
How big are these sheds?
Yeah, we're looking at about 2,500 square metres of shed space at the moment.
How much did it cost you?
The project was about an $800,000 project. Half of that was provided under the federal government's regional jobs and investment fund. As well as the sheds, the project's bought us an extra 5 positions here in Smithton, full-time positions. And of the $800,000, I think about 90% was spent in Tasmania and about 40% spent in the local circular head Smithton economy.
And they're not your average sheds, they're full of sensors. Can you run us through that?
Yeah, so we've got the University Centre for Sustainable Architecture with Wood working with us here in Smithton. So they're based in Launceston. So they've provided a series of sensors and weather stations. We've got them set up in the sheds. They monitor the weather conditions and the moisture content condition of the timber in Launceston and provide us with feedback of how the timber's drying. And from that, we'll work out over a period of time what the best schedules are to dry our timber quickly and for the best quality in the new facilities.
They've only been operational, say, for a few months. How are you finding it so far?
Yeah, so far so good. So early indications are that the timber is certainly drying quicker than it does in the traditional yard situation. Visual signs are showing less degrade than we potentially see in our traditional yard drying situations. So yeah, at this stage, so far so good.
Plans to build more in the future?
Potentially, we'll see what happens over the next 12 or 18 months.
Now, Sean, these sheds are also part of another project you've been working on.
Yeah, there's another little project that we've had underway for a while now, and that's installing solar panels on our roofs to create electricity to run our plant. So obviously energy, the cost of energy is one of the major cost factors of our business and operation, and controlling those costs into the short and long term future is something that we've been looking at options for quite a while. We obviously use our dry shavings to create the heat to dry our timber through our boiler, but obviously we still have quite a large electricity bill to process our timber and to cut our logs. So we've invested in just over $600,000 worth of solar panels at both our green mill and our dry processing plant.
Could you quantify that? Like, how big is this system?
Yeah, okay, so the system itself is a bit over 1,000 panels. I think there's 1,012 panels. It's a 300 kilowatt system, so your average house system might be 3 to 6 kilowatts. So this is a 300 kilowatt system, so it's quite large, and I'm not sure, but it's potentially the largest in northern Tasmania.
How much of your electricity bill would that be taken care of?
So we're expecting this system to generate approximately at least 25% of our power needs at the moment. Obviously, this time of the year, it's not producing a lot, but come summertime, it will be producing a substantial amount of our electricity. We've got a proposal to double the size of it, but we just need to get 6 to 12 months into this system first before we make a final decision on doubling the size of what we've got now.
What was the final decision behind getting that? Because in the past, obviously, solar panels wouldn't have been an option, really, in this part of the world.
No, look, we've seen several systems on the mainland which have been quite successful, and we've certainly been talking about our electricity prices here for a long time and how to contain them. Do we look at producing electricity through a larger boiler, or do we look at a solar panel installation? And eventually we decided to go with the solar panel installation. We operate on a 38-hour week, so outside of normal work hours when it's still sunny, and on weekends we will be feeding back into the grid. And our retailer is ERM, and they provide us with a one-for-one return on the power that we pump back into the grid.
It's Sean Britton, the General Manager of Britton Timbers in Smithton, talking there to Hugh Hogan, and they're already thinking about doubling the brand new solar power system. Still to come on the Country Hour, health problems for sheep as the trend to feed them under pivots increases, and we will check the latest on the weather. A political speechwriter from New Zealand has just written a book, but it's not about politics. It's about his experience working with a contract harvesting team in North America. Paul Savage explains how his adventure started.
Well, it started from when I was a kid. Because my cousins farmed and my uncle did, I always was interested in the land and tractors and that sort of thing. And by the time I was about to turn 28, I was getting itchy feet, and I thought, well, if I'm going to go and do something with farming, there's no time like the present. So I went online, started looking, and the rest is history.
So what took you to the States, though?
Well, I always liked John Deere. I'd be the kid that would always want a John Deere shirt or hat, and I looked up John Deere and saw Illinois and quickly worked out, well, if I want to be on the John Deere, I'm going to need to head to the States.
So you got a job with, what was it, like a harvesting company of some sort?
Yeah, that's right. It was a custom harvesting crew. So the way to think of it is basically a shearing gang, except they go around and harvest crops.
And at what stage did you think you might have the makings of a book?
Early on, we got to Minnesota, where my boss was based, and the first night we got in there, we went out for dinner, and I got to meet the guys, and I knew right there and then there's got to be a book that comes out of this trip. I had my iPad with me initially just to play poker on and to read Kindle books on, but it doubled as a very good tool to go and do a diary. So each day I would just open it up when I'd go to bed, and I'd just write what we did, who we saw, funny things that happened, and did that every day I was over there.
What were some of the funny things that happened?
Well, where to begin? There was the farmer in Texas who in May, he correctly predicted that Donald Trump would win the US presidential election in 2016. There was the constant humour from the Tennessee boys, and there was always a lot of good, healthy back and forth between me and the Aussie, me and the British guy, and me and the South African guys. It went on every day.
How were you accepted there?
Generally very well, in a nutshell. The Midwestern people were very welcoming. The Southerners were welcoming too, and particularly the people on my own crew. They knew that I didn't come from a full-time farming background, and I was upfront with them about it, but they couldn't have been better in helping me get up to speed and teaching me a lot of things and generally being very accepting.
But your accent must have generated a little bit of interest. Was there some interest from either the people in the United States or in Canada to a New Zealander?
Absolutely. More so in the States. I think coming from a New Zealand perspective, New Zealand considers Canada quite a similar country in many ways. And I got the feeling in Canada that they saw New Zealanders fairly often, so I wasn't much of a novelty there. But in places like Iowa, Nebraska and South Dakota, hearing a New Zealand accent, it really knocked the socks off a few people.
Now, when you say you work for a harvesting company, what was the arrangement there?
The arrangement was we would stay with that company for the duration of the season, so that would go from about late April till sort of end of September, start of October, and my role in that crew was to be one of the two chaser bin drivers. So typically the setup would be a family. Typically there would be one generation running it and then the next generation helping them or sort of co-owning it with them. So a family setup that would have many, many, many acres of land, and they would hire our crew to come and harvest it.
Is there something similar in Australia that you've seen or heard of?
Yeah, certainly that I've heard of. Out west, I should say, where I've harvested, it seems to be the family-run farms will have their own headers and chaser bins. But the Aussie boy that was over there with me, Calvin, who is from a place called Oakey, which I believe is near Toowoomba over in Queensland, which means he supports the right state of origin team, his parents run a custom harvesting outfit over there, and I understand there's a few of them there, but it's not quite as big as in the States.
So you've now taken a look at the way things are done in the United States and in Canada and here in Australia. You've been working on farms here in Australia for a while. What are the biggest differences?
Number one would be the pickup trucks, or the utes as we would call them. They're a lot bigger in the States and Canada, and many of them are petrol powered, because in the colder months a diesel can be notoriously difficult to start. And the other big difference would just be presentation. You know, and on an Australian farm, if there's an old auger, an old truck that's you know, reach the end of its marching days to put it to one side of the shed isn't a big deal. But in the States, you wouldn't be caught dead doing that. They'd have the thing oxy-torched up and cut off and send off the property by the end of today. So they're fastidious about keeping things clean and just the general appearance of their farm, right up to the front gate with the big stone sign and the manicured lawn.
And just getting back to where it all started, did you ever get quizzed about your background, being a speechwriter and someone with a communications background, when you're working on some of these farms?
Yeah, I don't think it was a profession that many of the guys were familiar with. If anything, they saw it as more of a novelty. And then if they needed to do a resume or have something written up, naturally they'd try and come to me for some help, which I gladly assisted with in exchange for beer and other assorted items. But yeah, I think it was more of a novelty than anything.
And so now you're finishing up soon here in Western Australia and you're about to go where?
Yeah, so I'll be harvesting in Western Australia at the end of the year, but in a few weeks I'll be back over to Canada to do the big harvest all over again, but this time it'll only be for about 2 months. But that'll be back in Saskatchewan at the very same farm that we were at 3 years ago.
You looking forward to that?
I can't wait. It's going to be great to be back.
So your boyhood dream of driving a tractor has been realised, but do you ever see yourself going back to being a speechwriter?
It's a decision I don't want to make right now, but I know I'm going to have to in about 6 months. So whether or not I do it full-time yet, I don't know for sure, but the speeches I wrote in 2016 definitely won't be my last.
Could you see yourself being a speechwriter for Donald Trump?
Well, it might be a shorter-term role because he's flicked a few people out the door pretty quickly, as I understand it, but if he's hiring, he can give me a call.
Kiwi speechwriter turned contract harvester and then author Paul Savage talking there to Richard Hudson about the making of the book he's just finished. It's called To South Dakota and Back, The Story of the Great North American Harvest. At the moment it's only available as a Kindle edition. He's still hoping to get it published. Still to come in the Country Hour, the ACCC and the Rural Co takeover, and also the olive grove where pruning by the big saw is just a normal part of the procedure. The chainsaw, that is. Time now to check the latest on the weather. Luke Johnston joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Luke.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, good. Rainfall figures, what have we got?
Yeah, quite a bit. There was a decent rain band yesterday, broadly across the north and the west, all 20 to 30 millimetres, but less than 5 millimetres in the southeast. 50 millimetres was the highest in Mount Victoria in the northeast, closely followed by 42 millimetres in Mount Reid. Since 9 a.m, we've had another 3 to 5 millimetres across the west and north. There's been some pretty decent showers scoot along the north coast in the last couple of hours. We have another cold front today. It's currently it's just past Wynyard in the northwest and is just arriving or just moving through Huonville in the southeast at the moment. So it's coming through quite quickly. It's only a little one. It's no massive rain band like the one yesterday. So for the rest of today, perhaps another 3 to 5 millimetres in the north and the northeast, another 10 or so millimetres for the west, but likely less than 1 millimetre for the southeast. The showers, once they make it to the southeast, kind of fall to bits and become much lighter, and it should be just a few isolated showers, perhaps a few more along the frontal band as it moves through the southeast over the next hour or two. Into tomorrow we'll see some more west and northwesterly winds. There's yet another front just clipping the far south this evening, so there'll be some more showers tomorrow about the west, the far south, the northeast, and Bass Strait as well. Possible showers, I'll say mostly elsewhere, because it's going to remain fine about the east coast. It's quite sheltered there in these westerly flows. Into Saturday, yet more showers for the west, far south, Bass Strait Islands, although they will finally start to decrease as a high over Victoria builds and ridges over Tasmania during the afternoon. On Sunday, some showers redevelop about the north and west, with a trough coming from the northwest headed southeastwards, although it's going to remain mostly fine for the southeast and the east coast for the end of the weekend. And then the next front looks like it's coming through later Monday, so it looks like back to northwesterlies again. So west to northwesterlies now, going northwesterly next week.
Okay. Have we got any warnings?
Warnings today, gale warnings current for western coastal waters from Tasman Island to Sandy Cape for westerly winds, and a strong wind warning current for all remaining coastal waters apart from the upper east coast. Small craft wind alert is current for the southwest and central plateau lakes today. Also today is a minor flood warning current for the north esk and south esk, just keeping an eye on the rainfall that fell that way yesterday and seeing how that's reacting to the rivers. So keep an eye out for those. Tomorrow, the gale warning is current for southern coastal waters from Tasman Island to Low Rocky Point for westerly winds. and a strong wind warning for eastern coastal waters from Wineglass Bay to Tasman Island and western coastal waters from Low Rocky Point to Sandy Cape. A small craft wind alert's current for the southwest lakes tomorrow too.
Okay, Luke, the coastal waters and the swell, what's happening there?
Sure. Today, west-northwesterly winds 10 to 20 knots in the east at the moment, increasing to 20 to 30 knots in the west, and then those 20 to 30 knots extend elsewhere during the afternoon, increasing further to 30 to 40 knots about the south and southwest today. The swell at the moment about the south and west is a westerly 3 to 4 metres. It will build towards 6 metres over the south later this evening. Across the north today, a westerly below 1 metre, building towards 2 metres offshore later today. Up the east coast, a southerly around 1 metre, grading southwesterly 2 to 3 metres offshore in the south. Tomorrow, we're looking fairly similar western-northwesterly winds, 15 to 25 knots, fairly consistent across all coastal waters, increasing to 25 to 30 knots over the southwest. The swell tomorrow starts off west to southwesterly in the southwest of 4 to 5 metres, decaying to 3 to 4 metres during the morning, so pulling back. The north westerly swell, about 1 metre, building to 2 metres offshore again, and up the east coast, very similar to today, a southerly around 1 metre, grading to a southwesterly 2 to 3 metres offshore in the south. And our wave rider buoy off Cape Sorel is reporting a significant wave height of 4.5 metres, and that's set to increase for the remainder of today.
Good on you, Luke. Thank you for that.
Thanks, Tony.
All the best. Luke Johnston from the Bureau with the latest information for you on the Country Hour. Coming up, the ACCC flags some concerns about the planned takeover of Ruralco. We'll visit a southern Tasmanian olive orchard in Campania and also talk about sheep health, with a lot more sheep being fed under the grassy irrigation pivots throughout the state. Could cause some health problems. We'll talk about that as well shortly.
What questions keep you up at night about climate change? We want to know. Curious Climate Tasmania is a new local project which lets you ask the questions.
Why is it so?
And we'll answer them with scientists and researchers.
It is important that we subscribe to the requirements of nature.
What are the climate questions for you? What are you noticing in your backyard or community? Are you wondering about lifestyle changes ahead? Any climate change question you have, we want to know. Ask us now. abc.net.au/Hobart.
On ABC Radio Hobart and Tasmania, you're with Tony Briscoe for the Tasmanian Country Hour.
And the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission has raised concerns about a proposed takeover of one of Australia's biggest rural suppliers. Nutrien, the owner of Landmark, flagged back in February that it wants to purchase Ruralco. But the deal requires approval of the ACCC and also the Foreign Investment Review Board. Now, Ruralco started life in Tasmania. The company continues to operate the Roberts brand in the state. Deputy Chair of the ACCC, Mick Keogh, says a merger between Landmark and Ruralco could reduce competition.
The Landmark and Ruralco businesses in combination would account for around 45% of the rural merchandise outlets throughout Australia. So that is a fairly significant presence. There would be only one other large-scale national retailer, which is, of course, Elders. So that raises a number of issues. One concerns the market power of that national entity. You could imagine that in negotiating with suppliers, for example, it would have significant ability to negotiate low prices. And then the issue is whether or not those low prices would be transferred onto farmers in the form of lower prices for the suppliers they purchase, or whether in fact due to lack of competition, that would in fact end up reducing competition. So that is the first issue. The second issue, which is related, is certainly in a number of regions that we've looked at, Landmark and Ruralco are the main rural merchandise outlets, and there's a few others. So when those two are combined in those locations, you could imagine that there's a likely reduction in competition in those areas, and that obviously has implications for farmers and others who are buying products in those regions.
And you've identified a number of those regions. Where are they?
Well, the ones we've listed include places like Broome, Alice Springs, Katherine, Darwin, Coomera in New South Wales, Hughenden in Queensland, and Rockhampton in Queensland. So they're ones where there's both Landmark and Ruralco corporate stores, and there's not many other competitors in those towns. So obviously they're ones where, at a local level, we would have concerns about as a result of the merger.
So Australia-wide, if this merger would go ahead, there could potentially be a duopoly between Landmark and Elders. What sort of impact do you think that potentially could have on farmers?
Well, the issue is whether that means farmers are still able to obtain rural supplies at competitive prices. But it also is the fact that both Ruralco and Landmark are significant wholesalers. In other words, they supply wholesale products to other retailers, other independent retailers. So the related question is whether or not those other independent retailers, who are often the main competition in some of the towns I mentioned, would still be able to source products at a wholesale level to be able to sell to their customers. And there are a number of other wholesalers of rural merchandise available, but Landmark and Ruralco certainly represent fairly major players in that market. So that is part of an added complication, if you like, of how the market would change as a result of this merger.
It's not all that common for the ACCC to issue a statement of issues on a proposed takeover. Why has this step been taken?
Well, we have a process, an informal clearance process. We subject any proposal like this to an initial review. When we reach a conclusion that there are issues that may be of concern, we provide an additional opportunity for the industry participants to make a response to that in the form of submissions. It's a fairly defined process, and we would look at those submissions, and we set ourselves a requirement to make a final decision the second week of August. So the time frame is reasonably short, but it is a formal process, and we do it to make sure stakeholders in the industry have adequate opportunity to look at the potential issues that we've identified and then to make their response as to whether they think they're of concern or not.
So this isn't an outright opposition to this takeover at this stage?
No, we regard this as an amber light. In other words, it's not a green light, it's not a red light. Depending on the responses we receive, there will be a final decision made on this, as I said, towards the end of the second week of August.
That's the Deputy Chair of the ACCC, Mick Keogh, speaking to Dan Fitzgerald about their concerns over the takeover of Ruralco by Nutrien subsidiary Landmark, and the ACCC is accepting submissions on the issue before making its final decision. On the Tasmanian Country Hour, access to irrigation water across the state has opened up some huge opportunities, and that includes running some big sheep numbers under pivots. But the lush feed they can produce is also leading to some health challenges in mobs. Consultant Paul Nyland explains.
Well, I mean, overall irrigation's been a boon because it allows us to increase our stocking rates and overcomes feed gaps. But three issues that we're seeing are firstly, hypercalcemia in ewes, particularly on irrigated winter cereals. The second issue we're seeing is the emergence of Barber's pole worm, which we've always known was here, but has, generally speaking, been non-clinical. Parasitism in general. Irrigation runoff can create suitable habitat for fluke, and that can be an issue for some people.
Hypercalcemia, how does that come about?
Grasses, and particularly lush winter cereals, are particularly low in calcium. So if sheep are exposed to it chronically, as the calcium requirement goes up in late pregnancy, and particularly if they're stressed, they can just tip over the edge and they go down in droves. Well, they can go down in droves.
So what's the best treatment option?
Prevention is way better than treatment. So if your sheep are on grass-dominant pastures, and particularly irrigated grasses and particularly irrigated cereals, they should be having calcium supplements of one form or another all through the winter. If, on the other hand, they're on mixed perennial pastures or dry pastures, don't supplement them then. Only start the supplementation at the time that they go on to the lush, low-calcium pastures. And the final point is that the risk of hypercalcemia is hugely reduced if you can perform your pre-lambing operations in a timely, deft and non-stressful way.
What time of the year or what time of the season are you seeing barber's pole emerging?
Our barber's pole issues at this stage are mostly seen in the late summer and into the autumn on the irrigated pastures, and therefore it's mostly in lambs. But the contamination that is laid down by those lambs in the late summer and autumn can be carried through by the ewes into the springtime, then it kicks off again in the springtime.
So what makes the conditions ripe for barber's pole to become dominant in those pastures?
Warmth and moisture. So traditionally, at the times when Tasmania have had the warmth, which is much later and not to the same extent as, for example, the Tablelands in New South Wales, we've not had the moisture. But patently, wet summers and also irrigation create that moisture.
Do you think lamb producers are doing as much egg testing as perhaps they should be?
Never. The simple answer is that a lot of the time people get a surprising result back and they say, gee whiz, you know, that it shouldn't be that high, we're going to drench. Now, if you're not egg testing frequently enough that you can preempt a rise in egg counts to a dangerous level, then you're not doing it with enough frequency. So for finishing lambs, particularly on irrigated pastures, the stock standard recommendation is that you should be monitoring every 3 weeks. And if you get a result that doesn't seem to fit with what you're seeing in the paddock, do another one straight away.
Fluke, is that an issue contained to the north of the state rather than the south?
No, not at all. The traditional fluke areas in Tasmania have been the highland areas, so the Central Plateau, some of the country near Lake Leek and the Derwent Valley. And that's been brought about because that country have lots of marshes and springs and so on, which will support the fluke habitat. However, the fluke areas are expanding because fluke habitat can be created by drains off irrigation paddocks returning to the main waterways. So, you know, for example, in the last 10, 12 years, we've seen the Back Creek around Longford become quite a substantial fluke area.
How do you avoid that? Those drains need to be in place, obviously, for the irrigation.
You can't avoid it. And, I mean, the other way that fluke spreads with some frequency is in a particularly wet year, the marshy areas on the lower South Esk and Macquarie Valleys may support fluke for a few years before it dries off again. The issue is to be aware of the possibility, particularly after wet years, and you can do that by, you can check that by monitoring in the mid to late autumn with a sedimentation test on the faeces, on the sheep that have been grazing those paddocks. Then you can act if you get a positive result. The big issue that we're confronting at the moment, in fact, is a large part of the state is well below average rainfall, and that means that lambing ewes are going into their lambing paddocks perhaps with an adequate tucker. Try and save up that tucker to an adequate level to ensure lamb survivability, and if that requires supplementary feeding to maintain, so be it.
Paul Nyland from Nyland Farm Health speaking there to Larissa Smith about sheep health. We'll talk olives and pruning olive trees in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Yumi Steins. Ladies, we need to talk about abortion.
I really don't like the word abortion. I don't know why. After having three, I should be able to get used to it. But for some reason, for me, psychologically, when I say termination of pregnancy, I don't know if it's like makes it seem more clinical. But for some reason, that's how I feel more comfortable.
Ladies, we need to talk. Find all new episodes wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
The Tasmanian Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and Tasmania.
Now, pruning olive trees with a chainsaw is not for everyone, but one Tasmanian olive grower says the trees love it. Fiona Mikowski and partner Glenn run the Freshfield Grove Olive Farm at Campania. The latest harvest is underway, and I caught up with Fiona in the pressing room at the Grove as the machine was processing olives for another grower.
I have been. I started pressing at the beginning of May, so we've done quite a lot of our own fruit, and I'm now doing some pressing for a few other people.
Describe the pressing machine for us. How does it work?
It's in several components. So the olives first go into a receiving hopper and then fall past a leaf blower and into a washing unit. They then get taken up to where the crusher is, and the crusher crushes the whole fruit, including the seeds, and that the fruit then falls into a malaxing tank, which is like a gigantic mixing bowl with paddles in it, and the fruit stays in there, the fruit paste, for about 45 minutes to an hour before it starts getting drawn out into the centrifuge. And the centrifuge is where the paste and the oil get separated from each other. So you have the oil coming out on one side of the machine and the paste coming out on the other side.
And you referred to that paste as something different.
Yeah, so the sort of proper term is pomace.
What happens to it?
I use it to put back onto the grove as a form of fertiliser. You can compost it more formally with other materials.
Okay, so you try and reuse as much as possible. This season, how's it been? It's been very dry, I know that.
It has been. We're very lucky to have irrigation here, so I was irrigating throughout the summer and up until about a month or so before I started harvesting. I'm really delighted with the fruit quality this year. I think the efforts I've been putting in with pruning and fertilising and irrigating over the last few years are really paying off. And then the whole harvesting and pressing is a fairly frantic time of year, trying to get everything coordinated, but it's going really well.
So where are you at with the actual harvest here at Freshfield Grove this year?
We've harvested about half of our grove, and then I've just paused briefly to do some pressing for a few other people, and I'll carry on with ours in the next week or two. And then we've got a community pressing day at the end of June, and any fruit I've got left over after that will get pressed at the beginning of July. So the idea behind that is that people who've got maybe a couple of trees in their backyard and would like to get some oil from it can bring their fruit along. It'll all go in the press on the same day together, and the resulting oil will be, it'll be a blend, and everybody that contributes some olives will get a share of that oil.
It seems to be the going thing with a lot of olive growers to introduce the community to events like this. What does the community get out of it, do you find?
I think people really love seeing where their food comes from, and for a lot of people that have got an olive tree, a lot of people pickle some of their fruit, but if they're getting more than sort of 10 or 20 kilos, it's maybe more than they want to do, and people hate seeing food that's on trees going to waste, so it's really nice to be able to bring it somewhere and actually get something they can use out of it.
Now tell us about your grove here. How old are the trees? And they look pretty good, they look pretty healthy.
Thank you very much. The trees were planted around 2002. We've got two Spanish varieties here, Picual and Manzanillo, with the Picual being mostly an oil variety and Manzanillo being more of a table olive variety. As I mentioned before, I've been doing quite a lot of work over the last few years, and pruning has been a really major part of that. And I think I am now starting to see some improvement in the tree shape.
Is there a special way you've learnt to prune the trees, or is it traditional?
There are lots of different ways described, and I think everybody sort of finds a way that suits them. I actually pruned with a chainsaw for the first time last year, following a really excellent session at the Australian Olive Association National Conference, and that took my pruning time down from several weeks to a matter of days. So the results look a bit brutal to start with, but the trees have grown into the space really well, and doing that has really opened up the canopy, so I'm going to carry on using that method.
I've got this visual picture of you armed with a chainsaw heading towards the trees, and the trees probably shaking.
Well, they seem to be quite happy with, as I said, having more light getting into the canopy, so... Yeah, some of them did look pretty lopsided when I'd first done it, because there were a few sort of really big branches that were very high that were shading out a lot of the rest of the tree. And so taking those off does make them look a bit odd for a few months, but they seem to be settling into it.
What about feed? What do you feed the trees with?
I use a mixture of things. So we put a lot of gypsum on the soil this year because our soil's a very heavy clay. And then I've been using an organic feed that's sort of molasses and seaweed based. And then around flowering time, I also applied some boron and some zinc to help with fruit set.
So it's been a quick learning process for you. You haven't been here that long, have you?
No, so we bought the property about 5 years ago, and yeah, it's been a very steep learning curve. I'm very grateful to a lot of other olive growers, both in Tasmania and outside, that have given me advice, and also some of the agronomists that have offered advice on how I can manage the place.
And they're steeped in history. I mean, the olive tree goes back to the start of civilization, really, and they grow a long time, don't they?
Yeah, it's actually the thing that I love about them the most, and I think that's what's drawn me to the crop overall. The fact that you can have a tree that's like 2,000 years old and it still produces fruit, it's just amazing.
At the Tasmanian olive industry, where would you describe it at the moment?
I think there's still a lot of room for expansion. A lot of the groves were planted a similar sort of time to ours, so they're all reaching maturity now. I think people are increasingly becoming aware of the fact that Tasmanian olive oil is a really great product. The first few years it was around, a lot of people weren't really familiar with the flavours of a cool climate olive oil, and it has got a very robust peppery flavour, which if you're used to oils from warmer climates can be a bit of a surprise. But most people really love it once they've sort of become accustomed to it. So there's a lot of potential for growth, both in the sort of local Tasmanian market, but also interstate and overseas.
Kind of like the wine industry in Tasmania, it's not really the bulk market you're looking for, it's more the niche market, the subtle changes in taste, etc.
Absolutely, and our volume of production is always going to be quite low because the groves here are quite small. They're very manually managed on the whole, so it's mostly hand picking. Our presses are small, and all of that contributes to a slightly higher cost of production to elsewhere. But I think because the flavours that we get are so amazing, you actually don't need to use a massive amount of the oil. It's perfect for a finishing oil. So I think spending a bit more on a small bottle and then using it just to finish off your dishes is the best way to do it.
Just describe to us how you harvest here. What happens?
So we're mostly harvesting with an electric hand rake, so it's attached to a battery and it's kind of like a rake with two sets of fingers that vibrate, and you kind of rake that through the trees and it knocks the olives off. We use an umbrella net under the tree, which means that we don't have to spread nets on the ground and then pick them up.
Is there much need for extra help on the ground here during harvest?
Yes, I've been employing people to help me pick because I'm running the press, so I can't do everything at once. So yeah, I found that a team of two or three pickers can pick at a rate that is good to run through the press at the same time.
And what about a future expansion here? Have you got much land to plant more trees? Is that the plan?
I think we've decided that we won't plant more olive trees here. There's definitely room for me to do more pressing for other people, and as I'm getting more experience with that, that's something I'm getting more confident about offering. But I think we're planting some native plants around the property, and at the moment we've got some people using the land for share farming for cereal crops, and that suits us very well currently. I think it's not going to be a multi-million dollar business anytime soon. I started expanding into table olives last year and they've been really popular, and I think that's another opportunity that gives me a chance to expand the business into a slightly different area.
It's Fiona Makowski from the Freshfield Grove Olive Farm at Campania, and the latest harvest there continuing. And if you go to our ABC Rural Facebook page, there is a video of the oil being pressed and what comes out on one side of the presser and what comes out the other side. That's on our ABC Rural Facebook page.